Blog Talk Radio.
You have made it to Stu and the Nun, an online radio show that looks to inform, educate, and hopefully make you laugh. Stu and the Nun is a show focused on national security, policy, politics, and selfless service. We do this by not only interviewing guests, but also sharing our perspectives and asking you, the listener, to interact with us on our show chat room, via our Facebook page, and on Twitter.
Good evening, everybody. This is the Nun of Stu and the Nun. You are listening live on Blog Talk Radio to the Stu and the Nun radio show. My main man, the Stu, is with us tonight. He is currently in the virtual green room conversing and contemplating with all things awesome and our guests. But just want to welcome everybody to the show. We had a great time last week. If you haven't had a chance to listen to us, from last week. Go back. We had General Abrams on with us last week. Great episode. Talked about all things ranging from his time in Afghanistan all the way to what it's like to be the Force Comm commander and dealing with the current political climate of that. But before we go any further, my brother from another motherland, Stu, what is going on with you?
What's happening, my brother Toby? How you doing, everybody? And great to be back for another episode of Stu and the Nun, wouldn't you say?
I would, but I was swallowing Guinness while you asked that question. So
oh, my bad.
A warning next time.
Yeah, I pass it off to you. I was sipping a little Labatt Blue Royale, which is the high alcohol, low light beer from Labatt Blue, one of my favorites at 6.something%. But anyways, yeah. Great to be back here on Stu and the Nun this other Tuesday night. Here we are looking forward here to episode 27, and tonight we are going to be talking to filmmaker director Tobias Lindholm. He's a Danish screenwriter and director, and he has been involved with some great movies and shows. Especially one he's really known for is Hijacking, and has won a lot of awards. And he has now made this new movie called A War, and it's a phenomenal piece. It's been nominated for an Academy Award in Best Foreign Language Film. It is a unique perspective from a Danish military point of view in the war in Afghanistan, and we're going to be talking to Tobias tonight about that, kind of what was behind the film, why they did some of the things they did, and it should be a great, great interview. It's already, we'll be putting up and talking about the links, but it's already in theaters all over the country, select theaters, and it's getting in more and more. And we'll be talking about that. So, and I'll give a little bit of my review at the end. So, hey, we have a great show lined up for him tonight, Tobe.
Well, I'm excited. You know, first of all, like, you know how I feel about filmmakers, and then filmmakers with the name Tobias. You know, even though my official Christian name is only Toby, I'd like to believe that, you know, it's a derivative of Tobias, and, you know, my parents were just too lazy when they were, like, explaining that to the people doing birth certificates. But, you know, vital statistics ended up giving me Toby, but I'm a Tobias in my heart, so I'm excited to talk to him. Plus, you know, this film's been getting, like, great reviews, great coverage. Anytime you are considered, even just considered, to be part of, you know, the Academy's award process, it's exciting. And I was a huge fan of Hijacking. I really liked that. And I thought, you know, he did a great job, and it was a craftily done film. So I'm excited to hear him and meet from him virtually. But we'll get to him because I believe he's in our green room and ready to go, correct?
Yeah, we sure will. And just to give people an idea on, you know, some people consider Rotten Tomatoes as like the real review site because there's, you know, there's professional reviewers and then there's, you know, people that, that really give their feedback on it. And this film scored 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, 84% on the audience score that liked it. So that's over 1,000 ratings given at that. That's pretty good. I mean, especially when you talk about something as, I won't say controversial, but I mean, there's definitely a lot of opinions on war and all that kind of stuff. So it has definitely definitely been received well. So, yeah, we can, we're looking forward to it. But, yeah, another great episode. Great to have everyone back on. And you ready to get to it, Toby?
Let's do it. Do it.
All right. Here we go. Well, I want to welcome to Stu and the Nun, famed director Tobias Lindholm. Hey, Tobias, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, guys. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Are you enjoying our warm weather?
You know what? The weather in Copenhagen right now is frosty and rainy and windy. And I am in the sun in California, so I couldn't be more happy.
Well, that's why, you know, we're excited that even though neither one of us are in California, we know you'd probably be getting a little bit of something refreshing from your long winter change. So we're happy to have you. Welcome to America and welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
All right, so we're gonna get right into it, Tobias. So it's a, I guess right up front, if you could kind of give our listeners a little bit of your background and kind of tie that into a little bit of what brought you to this film. I guess what attracted you to it and to direct it and that kind of thing.
Well, it's pretty simple, you know. The first two wars that Denmark basically ever fought was in Iraq and Afghanistan just after 9/11. We were defending ourselves for 5 hours in the Second World War, and then we gave up. So, you know, as you can imagine, there's nothing that has defined my generation more than we became the warfaring generation. Suddenly, we had professional soldiers. We had friends and brothers who went abroad far away from home and fought these political wars that was, at least for a civilian Danish population, hard to understand what we were doing there. So I knew, you know, that there would be a story there to tell eventually. The post-Vietnam films in the 70s and 80s meant a lot to me as a filmmaker and as a young guy. And I remember feeling that we were in a, you know, small-scale post-Vietnam phase in Denmark at the time, after spending a decade in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I decided to start to look for stories to tell, and I couldn't really find one until I read this interview with a Danish officer who said, going on his third tour to Afghanistan, and he said he wasn't afraid of getting killed down there. He was afraid of getting prosecuted when he got back home. And the complexity of that statement just stuck with me, and I knew that there was a story there to be told. So that became the starting point, and from then I started to dig and, you know, do a lot of research. I've never been a soldier, so... So I knew I needed to get in contact with Danish veterans that had spent their lives in Afghanistan, and luckily I found a fantastic group that would start to share their experiences with me, and that became the starting point for this film. That you can say is the first Danish war film, and the first film confronting what it has been like for our soldiers to be out there.
Absolutely, you know, as a veteran of Afghanistan myself, I can tell you this hit very close to home with me, and it drove a lot of questions after I watched it. I mean, one of them is right up front. You kind of alluded to it is the technical advice, the military advice. The soldiers, the veterans you talked to, did you bring them on as advisors? And how was that? How did that whole process go?
Well, as you guys know, you know, magical things happen when you have alcohol. And I was at a wedding, and it was a wedding where I spent a lot of time at the bar at that wedding. And luckily, another dude called Martin did as well. And Martin had spent, you know, two tours in Iraq and two tours in Afghanistan. And because we weren't sober, we, you know how conversations can elevate when you're drunk. And they definitely did at that wedding. So he started to share with me stuff that, you know, that he had experienced, and he became my first guy in, and he would get along some of the guys that he served with. So suddenly I had this group of 8-12 soldiers that had served together in Afghanistan, and they would share, and you know, I just, well, not in a romantic way, but in a professional way, I fell in love with everything that they knew and did. So I actually asked them to act in the film. So we only have a couple of actors in there, and the rest is just veterans that know what they're doing and that have, you know, spent time there. So what you see on screen is Danish veterans who spent time in Afghanistan, and I guess that the professionalism of those guys, you know, gives the realism to this film. So I owe a lot to those guys.
Yeah, Tobias, you just said something that, you know, it doesn't matter what country you're from, what language you speak, the human condition, that experience of combat, and, you know, a couple of guys, you know, a couple of dudes, you know, getting together, having a couple of drinks, and, you know, that lubrication, you know, to feel comfortable to kind of share those things, like that's indicative of all veterans. And that's, I think, why, you know, Troy made the comment earlier, like, this is, even though the film, you know, being in a different language and, you know, being in a different uniform to what we're used to, like, this is the experience that we relate to. This is, you know, the endearing combat experience. And I found it very interesting how you said that, you know, you felt like this was the first war that y'all fought in and actually fought. You know, I remember back in the Balkans in the 90s, you know, I had the pleasure of working with what we call the Nordpol Brigade, which had some Danish troops, some Swedish troops. And, you know, so, like, everyone knows the competence level of the Danes and knows that y'all are, like, just some warfighters. And, you know, like, all the way back to centuries past, you know, with the Viking invaders, you guys are, you know, a fierce culture of warfighter. So it was really neat to see that. And I thought it was pretty cool that out of a wedding in a drunken stupor, you found your technical consulting.
Well, you know, that's what it is. So I guess that what you can take from that is, you know, always have a drink more and, you know, start
one
to
more.
Have a talk. And one more and great stuff will happen. You know, I agree, and thank you so much. I mean, I found it interesting that because the Balkan, we were part of a peacekeeping mission, right? And the big
Correct.
Problem for the soldiers down there were that that there was no peace to keep. And that became a huge trauma for those guys. Now, the guys going to Iraq and Afghanistan, they went on a mission, on a warfaring mission. And that was completely different, at least in the infrastructure in the Danish military, had to change at the point. So the officers that went down and had the first young guys in Iraq and Afghanistan really never fought that kind of wars themselves. So as you can imagine, it has, you know, it has evolved Danish military and how we look at soldiers in Denmark during the last decade. When we've actually been out there in war, not just in a political correct peace preventing or peacekeeping mission, but actually going out there and becoming part of what we earlier could look at as an aggressive American thing. Do you know what I mean? And that changed Denmark a lot, and I found that extremely interesting because for me it was necessary. It was too easy. I mean, I haven't been a soldier, and it was so easy to sit in my couch at home and be judgmental to what happened down there. If I heard about killing of civilians, it would be so easy for me to blame soldiers because I didn't understand the reality of it. And therefore, my mission became to humanize these guys, not to humanize the actions. I don't, you know, I'm not interested in that, but humanize them, at least present them as human beings with real lives and real fears and real, you know, real joys so that we can relate to the soldiers that have this job, you know, that's given this job by our democracy. It's part of us all. And sometimes, at least in Denmark, it's too easy for people to sit down and say, well, I was against the war, so it's nothing to do with me. I totally disagree. I feel that it's part of us because it's part of our democracy, and we need to look at it that way.
So just quickly, Tobias, was there a point that your opinion of what was going on was dramatically changed? Did your personal point of view change on what was globally happening as a result of your experience in meeting guys and then going forward with this film?
I mean, what we did was, yes, I changed many times, and I have to say I realized pretty early that it was way too complex for me to just have one certain opinion about it. You know, we went down to Turkey and we found a refugee camp full of refugees from Helmand Province, and suddenly I could, you know, speak to those guys and talk to them about their experiences. And what I realized is not all of them is against this war. A lot of them actually felt that it was necessary for Afghanistan to have a future. And then suddenly, you know, there's no political correct opinion about it. It's an extreme complex thing. And I have to admit, I still find it too complex to actually really understand it. But what I do understand is the humane perspective of it, to look at these guys as human beings, both the Afghans and the Danes in the war down there, and take a look at the veterans and say, well, it's a life that I cannot imagine. I haven't been in those situations. So instead of me having an opinion, I better just listen to what they have to tell. And hopefully we can all learn from that.
Yeah, it's, you mentioned something, Tobias, the folks you ran into in Turkey. Is that, I mean, the one thing I noted, as me and Toby were talking about before the show, was the Afghan actors portraying the Afghan civilians in the film were so spot on to me, so realistic. The language, the dialect, the speed at which they talk. I mean, were those some of the folks? I mean, how did you come across those folks? Were those refugees from Afghanistan? Because they were 100% on point.
But they were all refugees from Helmand Province. So we just found them in the refugee camp. And the family you see in the film is a family that escaped on, you know, on the back of a donkey because it got too threatening to stay there. So all of them, even the Taliban guy on the motorbike, is a refugee from Helmand Province. And they all came in, and basically what we asked them to do was to decorate, you know, help us build the village so that it would look exactly like a village in Helmand Province. And I knew I needed the Helmand guys because they spoke the dialect that our military translator could speak because they had served in Helmand. So I needed the guys because I didn't want our actors to fully know what the Afghans was gonna say. So we just translated it live on set, and then my actors had to react to what the Afghans were telling them instead of just waiting for their time to say the line. And that all, of course, added to the realistic atmosphere that we was hoping for.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I like it. That's pretty cool how you did that. Now, you said most of the people representing the serving as soldiers were actual soldiers. Were the folks in the courtroom, or were some of the folks, the prosecutor and some of the folks in that, without giving away too much of the film, were they real attorneys and real stuff? Were those actors, or did they come from the legal profession?
The judge is a real judge. She just, you know, she retired 2 weeks before we started to shoot. So she took control of that courtroom, I can tell you. I mean, you know, usually I'm in charge on set, and I have to say those weeks shooting in courtroom, I was the assistant of the director. She took complete control, which helped us a lot. The two attorneys there, the prosecutor and the defense lawyer, is both actors. But behind them, every day, we would have the military prosecutor of Denmark and a defense lawyer who had taken a lot of these cases for officers back in Denmark. So they would be right behind us and you know, telling us how to do stuff. But they were not allowed to be on camera because it would be really strange for them to do a case the next week, now being the guys from that film. So
right.
So we needed actors for those parts. But basically the rest of the courtroom and the witnesses there is all the soldiers that served.
Wow. Now, did as you got all these stories starting at the wedding and so on and so forth, were there any stories that this is kind of loosely based on? Because I can tell you, having been there, there was a lot of this kind of stuff that happened. And every time that someone pulled the trigger, we always worried that there was going to be an investigation, even though we were in combat and it was completely justified. So I'm just wondering, was there something that really happened that caused the theme of this, the plot?
There was one case at a point where an officer had ordered a bombing and he was prosecuted afterwards. It wasn't the same. He was in camp and basically overviewing on camera stuff. But I based some of the logic off it, and then I would do a lot of research, and I would build the trial and the whole thing together with the prosecuting team in the Danish military. So, you know, we would go through the logic of it and see what could possibly happen in situations like this. And then I would go and take those facts, and I would, you know, sit down in a meeting with all my veterans, and I would say, okay, if we need a situation to be like this, what would it be like? Where would you be? How could you end up in a situation like this? And then they would start to share experiences and stories, and I would take bits and pieces of it and fit it all together into this one story. But it's all taken from, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 different stories and anecdotes that I heard from down there. And then a lot of it would change again when we came down, because then I started to talk to the Afghans, and they were like, well, that's true, but in a cultural way, we would do it this way or that way. And then suddenly we needed to adjust to that reality as well. So so it's all built on facts and stuff that I've heard, but it's not one story. It's a lot of different stories. I remember, though, one day, you know, the whole opening of the film, not giving away anything, is when Anders, a young guy, steps in an IED. And I remember we were testing in an area in Turkey. We were testing it, and I brought all the veterans out, and they would walk in formation, and not all of them were supposed to be there. So one of them, you know, dropped down in a hole and placed himself. And I said, well, how do you know that this is how Lasse would be? Anders, the guy that stepped on the ID, how do you know that it would look like this? And he said, well, this is what my younger brother looked like. And I remember, you know, that day I went home to my hotel room, and I was suddenly doubting whether we could morally do this, whether I was challenging them too much, or, you know, bringing memories alive that, you know, had been better off. So I would wake them all up again, and we'd share a bottle of whiskey and talk about it. And they all appreciated it, and, you know, told me how much they appreciated actually being able to talk about this in a professional manner, about how we could do it in a film instead of it being part of a therapy thing. So we continued doing it. But once in a while, we got very close to reality, also in a way that scared me.
Right. Yeah. It was very real. I mean, I'm just astounded at as I was watching it, just like, say, how realistic the actors were. The Afghans and all that was real, and the injuries I figured came from, you know, firsthand experience of what it looked like, how the guys reacted, both the wounded and the ones, including in the firefights. I mean, a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos, people trying to identify. I mean, all that stuff was spot on. But you mentioned something a second ago. You mentioned the Danish military. Were they supportive of this? Did they help you on this and work with this? And if so, or if not, how have they received it?
They actually helped us a lot, and they gave me and they gave their attorneys work time to work on this film, and they helped us with equipment and a lot of stuff that made us do this. And they never really wanted to read a script. They knew me from the film I did before, Hijacking, and they appreciated the realism of that. You know, it wasn't judgmental; it was just showing a piece of life and how stuff is out there. And I felt that they believed in us. They knew that we were not out to show how brutal they were. We were out there to actually make a document about how life had been in Afghanistan. So they jumped right in and helped us all they could. With equipment and knowledge, so you know, we appreciate that help. And a lot of the guys that still serves and works in the military could do it on their work time, you know, work on the film. So they helped us a lot.
Well, that's pretty. That's a lot more lenient than I think the U.S. military allows. How is this received at home, and then in Europe in general, and how has it been received in America so far?
Well, it's kind of fun because in Denmark, traditionally, you would see artists being traditionally against war, no matter what. So for the Danish audience to suddenly see a film like this that is humanizing the soldiers and not defending their actions, but definitely questioning whether we can actually be judgmental about it or not, surprised a lot of people. And I think that a lot of people were conflicted. They didn't really know what to think. I mean, my mom is a fantastic lady. I love her a lot, but she's a classic Scandinavian socialist. And she brought me up with the believing that, you know, rich people have stolen their money from poor people. And around the age of 15, I probably realized that wasn't the full truth. But nevertheless, I remember thinking, I'm going to write a story where I get my socialist, great, left-wing Scandinavian mother to sympathize with a war criminal. If I can do that, then I get the complexity of this. So that became the aiming point. And I actually have to say that I guess I succeeded then. And that's the confusion this story has left in Denmark. And now bringing it over and realizing that it's translating over here, but in a way where there is traditionally told more stories about war. And it's the U.S. is a country that traditionally has been to a lot more wars. It's a slight different approach to the film. It's not really different, but you know, I definitely see that people are used to at least respecting the effort of the soldiers.
Yeah, in case you are just now tuning in, we are talking to director Tobias Lindholm, and he is the writer and, I guess, writer and director of the film A War, a Danish film on Afghanistan, just in case anyone's tuning in late. To get back to you, Tobias, let me ask you, you know, I got to say, when I first started watching it, I was like, oh, subtitles, you know, and I was kind of taken back a little bit, but as I watched it, and got into it, I enjoyed that there were subtitles for two reasons. One, because it helped me not miss anything. In films like Kilo 2 Bravo and other films from foreign countries that maybe even that speak English, the accents are so heavy or the slang is so heavy, you miss a lot of that. But also, it let me, as a former soldier myself, I didn't need the language when it got into the firefights and to the other, you know, intense scenes. I could just by their tone and stuff, I knew what they were saying without even having to read it. So I'm curious what that has been like in the States to have the subtitles. Have you gotten any negative feedback on that? Has it been positive or anything at all?
I think that the only thing, it limits our market in the U.S. that we have subtitles. There's a lot of people that think that it's going to be boring or hard to watch because of subtitles. But that, I guess that's the only reaction. A lot of, and which I have appreciated a lot and shared with the veterans when I called them back home, you know, shared with them that it translates really well. And you would, I mean, talking to you guys and other veterans, both in UK and US, that we've shown this film to, the positive response that we've had, of course, from the film community, and we are Oscar nominated, and that's fantastic. But for me, it means a lot, especially the veterans actually see and recognize that their reality is portrayed honestly and loyal. And with the language as well. I mean, in Denmark, a lot of people wanted subtitles because they don't understand the military lingo anyway. So when somebody's talking about a nine-liner, everybody's like, what? And I felt that it didn't really matter because on a human level, we all understand the situations they're in. I mean, when Lasse is in there crying, and I just seen his best friend bleed out on the ground, I know why he's crying. So I don't really need to understand what he's talking about. I know the situation he's in. And I feel that on a universal level, we are actually, no matter language or subtitles or not, we are able to speak to each other because we all relay on a human level. And I feel that the film and the live it has gotten internationally in some way proves that.
What a great point you just made, Tobias, about like even those within the same language not understanding the jargon or the lingo within the military. Like here in America, you know, where English is kind of spoken, you know, the military has its own language unto itself, you know, with a lot of acronyms and, you know, the slang terms. So it's what a great point that you just made because, you know, we always think of it as a big general type mentality and bringing it right back down to, like, people here, if you said the word nine-line, wouldn't know what a nine-line is.
No, exactly, but I know watching it that they're struggling to save somebody's life, and that's enough for me. And then I have to say, for me, it meant more that I wanted veterans around the world to feel that their reality was portrayed correct, more than I needed civilians to understand any word being said, because the basic conflict of this story is understood by anybody. So I rather wanted it to be as close to reality as possible, and that's why I brought in the soldiers in the first place. So, you know, what we did was, and they really hated me for the report in the beginning, but I would place an officer beside me by the monitor, and I'd give him a radio, and we would do all the radio communication live on set. So he would, you know, pretend that he was in the talk, asking them stuff and, you know, telling them stuff. And that meant that I could confuse them because they never knew what was coming. So I would, you know, I would give them detailed or ask them detailed questions, and they would, in the heat of fire, while I have explosions going on just beside them, and they would need to still, you know, return to the talk as they would have done in real combat. And that gave them, you know, that offered them the opportunity to just react to the situation they were in instead of suddenly thinking they were supposed to be acting. I didn't need that. I just needed them to do whatever they do, either when you are in combat or when you're rehearsing. Because what I realized about soldiers is you have rehearsed so much. You've done it over and over again, so you know it so well. And you know, that's what you appreciate when you do films. I mean, you can't say that about actors. You know, as a joke, I always say that the difference between working with soldiers and actors is that soldiers come on time and do as they're told. And you know, actors
don't. Brilliant.
So it was wonderful to have them there. And just you know, sometimes it felt like I was doing a documentary, but because, yes, I was controlling stuff, but I actually was also just a spectator, looking at the monitor and seeing these guys doing their job. And that was fascinating to see that, you know, grow out of nothing in front of me.
Well, I think it's brilliant how you challenge them by, you know, keeping it fresh and making them reactionary versus, you know, repetitive. That's brilliant. Now, with I just have a quick one for you, but with hijacking, you really were kind of in front of everyone on that film. You were in front of everyone on that storyline. You really set the tone. You know, American movies came out afterwards. Like I'll reference Captain Phillips. It fell short of what you did there. What consideration in terms of timing did you take in the release of this film? Or was it just you didn't take that into consideration? You just felt so strongly about this project and the process that you just said, I know other films have come out, let me just put this out there because, you know, I believe it'll be good.
You know, I'm good at writing and once in a while directing films. I'm not good at the game. I don't really understand it, so I leave that to my producers. What I know is when my, you know, when my pulse rises and I can't sleep much because I'm thinking about a story, that's the time to write it. Luckily, with you know, what actually happened with the hijacking was I was writing it, and then I read that Captain Phillips had been greenlighted with Tom Hanks and Paul Greengrass. I was a huge fan of Paul Greengrass. But I saw that, and then I ran to my producers right away and said, we have to start shooting this summer because we don't want to be the cheap Danish version of this film. You know, so that was the reason that we came out early on that one. It was all coincidence. And then I, you know, from a private point of view, I had twins. So my wife asked me to not go shoot for 2 years because it was too hard to be alone with the kids. So, you know, a week later than they turned two, we were on to do a war. So it was all timed to the age of my children and nothing else.
Brilliant. Brilliant. You know, like, we all like to think that we're in charge, but our wives really are. You know, like,
and that's half this film is.
So I will save my next question about timing for your wife.
Do that.
Now, being separated, you know, from your family, did that help kind of inspire? Because one of the things you craftily did with this is that you showed both sides consecutively about being away and being at home and, you know, how, you know, the child is struggling, you know, the mom's trying to hide the fact and present that everything's okay here. You worry about the car, I'll worry about the kids. Was your time away doing filming both with hijacking these other films, obviously a war, was that inspired at all by the time of your twins?
Well, definitely. I mean, it became my emotional window in the story. You know, I haven't been a soldier. I couldn't relate to those situations. I could just be a tourist and listen and hopefully get some of it. But I know about the feeling that you can't emotionally connect with your family on a broken phone line and the frustration that gives you. You know, and in my situation, I'm always on a, you know, I'm on a film set or in a hotel and not in war. So I can only imagine what it must be like. But nevertheless, it gave me an opportunity to emotionally, you know, relate to those guys. And which is why the phone calls for me is so important, both in a hijacking and especially in a war. Because I've been in those situations and my boys at home have started once in a while to react that I'm not there. And it's part of my job, as it is part of a soldier's job, to not be at home all the time. And it definitely is something that I understood and related to. So I needed that in the story. And I needed it because, you know, often when we see war films, we see guys in uniforms. And it's part of a dehumanization because everybody look alike. So you're not really sure who's who. And it's pretty easy as the spectator to that to just, you know, then it's just soldiers. It's not real human beings. It's guys in uniform. But if you give a guy a wife and three kids and a home, you know, then suddenly he becomes a real person. He becomes somebody's father and somebody's husband and somebody else than the other soldiers rely on him and have their lives in his hands. And that meant a lot for me to paint a full picture of a human being instead of just portraying a guy in a uniform.
Yeah, Tobias, this is Troy again. I want to highlight one thing, and it's the last scene of the movie. That probably, for me personally, had one of the strongest impacts. And I know you crafted it the way you did, but when he covered, you know, his little boy's feet, and he looked at those feet, mm-hmm. and covered them up with that bedspread, man, that struck me hard. I mean, I was, I don't know, my sinuses were kicking in or something. I had to grab a tissue there, but it was because I know exactly what he was seeing. You know, having been there myself, when he saw that, I knew it took him right back to that moment when he was in Afghanistan. And I got to say, that was was that something that you planned for and wrote, or is that something that came about during the movie? Did that scene come about and get developed then?
Oh, first of all, thank you so much. And for me, it's a proof that we don't need flashbacks to understand what's inside the head of people. We can just watch them, and we'll get it. And I think that the audience is much more intelligent than we often give them credit for. Yes, it was planned. I mean, you know, I remember the day when we did the feed in Afghanistan with the family being there. And the Afghan family had, you know, kept their kids awake so they could nap for the afternoon when we were doing that scene. So the kids was just asleep. And while he was asleep, you know, I would put some sugar water on the kids' feet. And because I knew there was flies around, so I was hoping for a fly to come sit. And for some reason, a fly comes and sits on his foot, and that tells you that he's dead. That fly coming sitting there. And, you know, I had written it, and I could only hope for that perfect an image. I knew that I could create it at home with my Danish axes in a bed with a small boy. But I knew if I could just put that shot, I mean, then we would emotionally get a throwback to the middle of the story where everything changed. So thank you. And yes, it was planned. And it's, I mean, it fascinates me all the time how much we as human beings connect to simple images like, you know, children's feet. It can tell such a wonderful, crazy, big story just watching two different kids' feet in two different situations.
Yeah, how was the, we talked about the Danish military reception and the reception in different countries, but have you gotten any feedback from military families, either in, either at home or here in the U.S.? Have you heard anything from the wives, from the parents, feedback on the film?
Yeah, I have to say that's been the most incredible journey in this whole Academy thing, is the fact that we've been out here showing the films to people. And I have to say, every time I've met a soldier and a spouse, it has moved me a lot. There's great emotional connection between these families and this film, and I appreciate it a lot. Back in Denmark, the day after the premiere, I was taking my kids to school, and this guy stopped me in the street while I was with my three small boys, you know, and then he started to cry. And I was a little afraid because I didn't know him. So I was like, who is this guy? And then he said, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate it. I saw your film last night with my wife. I haven't slept all night because we've been speaking, and I have told her for the first time in 10 years, I've told her about what happened when I was in Afghanistan. And she's told me about the life that she had with the kids. And I actually think that we have a future now. And, you know, he was crying then and he left. And I remember I called my actors and some of the soldiers right away and said, well, you know, pardon my French, fuck the reviewers. We've made a film that has an impact. So we have luckily have responses from families, and it's all been positive. And I feel that there's something in this film that's unique. I didn't know it, but I guess the fact that we spent so much time describing the lives on the home front as well from a very loyal and realistic perspective moves a lot of people, and we appreciate all the comments we get on that.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, you know, it's you know, it's inspiring too. Like you mentioned earlier, you don't play the game. I mean, you see a story, you hear a story, you see there's a need for it to be told, and it's so refreshing. I mean, I can tell you, you know, there's been, you know, this is now the second movie we've screened, and we've had people on. You know, we had the director of Kilo 2 Bravo. We've seen that one. We've seen this one. Both foreign made films, you know, about Afghanistan. And the same as we said about that movie, I can say about this one, and that is, it is so refreshing to see a movie that is not full of explosions and gunshots and blood and gore. There's some in there because it has to be, but you tell so much more of the human spirit story in this. You know, not only the brotherhood, but also the family human spirit. And it's refreshing to see that. And it seems to be, it takes filmmakers outside of the U.S. to do that.
Well, thank you so much. And then I have to point it back, because for me to make this film, I saw the American documentary Restrepo. And for me, that film changed everything. I remember there's a scene in that where a soldier have an anxiety attack, a nervous breakdown, in the middle of a battle, in the middle of a gunfight, because one of his friends is shot and dead on the ground. And I had never seen that before. And the terror and the at the same time very human reaction I saw there reminded me that soldiers are human beings, and we need to tell stories about them as human beings. So again, yeah, I'm happy you say that, but I have to send a lot of credit back to that documentary, for me at least.
So, I mean, Restrepo was, you know, really a groundbreaking film here in America, because, you know, Sebastian Younger and, you know, Tim Hetherington, they did a great job, one, on documenting the embed, and not doing like a kind of a surface level film, but really getting into it and showing all aspects. And so I'm really excited that, you know, you acknowledge their efforts there, because I thought that was truly groundbreaking. But now that you've been in the U.S. for a little bit, you know, for a couple of weeks, or you're going to be here a couple of weeks, like, what do you think of everything that's going on here? How do you think, not just with the reception of the film, but with, you know, we're in an interesting time in America. We're in an election cycle. We're in a sports season cycle. So, like, all these pop culture and political things are, like, kind of coming to a head. How do you feel, like, because you're kind of participating?
You know, I'm still trying to grasp with it. And to be honest, you know, I'm between Los Angeles and New York. And I'm not even sure if that's real America, if you know what I mean. I haven't spent time in that much time in you know, in the Midwest. I haven't gone to the South. I haven't been in the places where life is lived by ordinary American people. So you know, I wouldn't say I know anything about it, but I have to say one thing, is that I recognize the fear that I see here, the fear of the future. You know, times are changing. I grew up in a world where you had the Cold War, and we had, you know, either you were capitalist or you were communist, and that was a pretty simple way of looking at stuff. And the way things are going now, it's getting more and more complex and harder to understand exactly what's going on. And that's scary. And in Europe right now, we see the refugee crisis, and that's scary. And I definitely feel the same fear interfering with intelligence and emotions over here.
No, it absolutely does. And one of the reasons why I wanted to ask that question is, you know, we get so isolated here. It's hard to explain, but even though we're one of the larger geographic countries in the world, and being that, you know, we only have two other countries on our continent, we can still be extremely isolated, and we forget all these other things out there. And it's great to hear the reflections of someone that's traveling and seeing it. Like, our view of the refugee crisis isn't, you know, from firsthand experience. Our view of the refugee crisis is, you know, from our military experience and what we know is possible. You know, Europe is seeing the crisis, you know, in their face. It's happening. It's on their streets. It's in their homes. It's a reality for us. You know, it's, right now it's argumentative. It's a political talking point. But, you know, so many of these political talking points, you know, they're very polarizing. But, you know, because we're so detached from some of these things being in our face, you know, all of a sudden what happens with Kanye West or Portland, you know, refugee crisis. And
you know, I made the decision a while ago to acknowledge how complex it is and insist on just looking at it from a human perspective. And being the father of three small kids, I have to say that I understand any father who moves his children from Syria and up north to find a better life. And that's the only viewing point I can have. Now, is that going to create problems in Europe in the future? Yes, it does already. But I cannot accept that we are too self-good in Denmark right now to at least do whatever we can to help these people. We have never been more involved in creating waves of refugees because we are participating in the war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and now in Syria. And nevertheless, we have never been more scared and more closed. And I think that that complexity and the conflict is right now terrorizing my country in a way that I'm scared of. So for me to come over to U.S. and feel the same, but also see a country that have been in these situations before, seeing the world change, comforts me in a way, because I at least know that, you know, we're not looking at the end of the world. And you know, that's what I get of the visits over here. It gives me a feeling that, you know, there's hope, and let's go home and do whatever we can to help the people who need help and find a way to solve the problem that have been created in Europe right now.
Well, Tobias, I got to tell you, you know, you're a fantastic filmmaker. If you're ever in Texas, I will give you some really good whiskey, and we'll always have one more. And I'm excited to meet you. You know, you're a skilled craftsman. You're an artist, but you're a human, and I think you've done a great job. We wish you all the luck with this film. You will hear nothing but praise and support from us, and we're going to share it in our community and get, you know, as many veterans behind you all as we can, because I think you've done a good thing here. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for coming to America to promote this great work. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I promised my sons to go to Texas and get boots and hats. So, you know, I'll take you up on that whiskey.
Well, I tell you what. If you come to Texas to get boots and hat, you come to Austin, Texas, and I will help you get that taken care of.
I promise you that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tobias. Is there anything else you want to tell our listeners before we let you go? We appreciate all the time you've given us tonight. Is there anything you want to let our listeners, any words you want to depart or leave them with?
Well, no, just thank you. And, you know, watch the film, and you know, feel free to reach out as veterans or as families. You know, feel free to reach out and share your experiences. I can only learn from it. So I appreciate all the time you give me, guys. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you so much. And, you know, stay in touch with us. You know how to get a hold of us. Anything else coming up or anything you want to let us know about, we'd love to have you back on for sure.
Thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. You have a great night.
You too. Thank you.
All right, everybody. That's Tobias Lindholm. Check it out, magpictures.com/AWAR. magpictures.com/AWAR. That's where you can find it at. The theaters are on there. All the show. I just saw that on March 4th it's going to be playing right down the road from where I live. Even though I've already seen it, I'm probably going to take some friends or family to go see it. And it's playing all over the country. And hopefully to be on digital here soon too, so people, if it doesn't play, they can get a chance to grab it. But truly a mark. And what a great dude, huh, Toby? Just solid.
Well, you know, like, so, you know, in your mind, you have, like, this vision of, like, the stereotypical guy that you think he is, and then he ends up being a really cool dude with great vernacular, whiskey drinking, and he did it right, like, you know, doing the radio calls and changing them up, forcing guys to think through things and process them, and even though, like, they rehearsed, like, keeping it raw, you know, like, I know in film, like, some great stuff has happened. You know, here are the Singletary brothers, you know, in Boys in the Hood, you know, did a live drive-by, or pretended to do a drive-by to get that reaction. and doing stuff like that. I mean, like, that's what filmmaking's all about, really pushing the envelope, pushing the limits. This guy did it, and as a result, it's, you know, from Denmark to America to the Academy Awards. I mean, how about that? That's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, like you talked about the radio calls, the translators, the interpreters doing that, you know, it reminded me a lot of, I forget the gentleman's name. I interviewed him a long time ago on the old show, but in the movie Act of Valor, you know, which was about the SEALs, you know, when I interviewed that, the filmmaker that at one of the Milblog conventions, he told me that the whole scene in the boat was, you know, the Navy, the chief was a real interrogator, and there was no lines, no script. The actor knew what information he had to give up, and that whole thing was just free flow, and they shot that whole scene in one scene with no breaks. And the actor had no idea what was coming at him. And when he was talking about that, it reminded me so much of that, of not ad-libbing, but allowing the emotion and allowing really the actors to, and those, you know, portraying, I guess, being actors, to really live in the moment, and it seems to be it seems to work, you know. And like I said, it started with whiskey, started getting hammered at a wedding, and he talked about, you know, same thing when he would wake up at night or when he would hear stuff, he would call the actors, also known as the soldiers themselves, to tell them. I mean, what a great director. He's given them instant feedback as soon as he's getting it as he's traveling around.
The guy did it right. And telling both sides of the story, you know, the war front, the home front, you know, going through some of the reviews, some of them weren't flattering. But, you know, again, anytime someone steps out and tries something different, you know, people fear change. Fast and the Furious 28 coming out.
In Rocky 17. You know, I didn't say it to him, but I mean, I tell you, it was every parts of the movie I was very frustrated, not at the movie, but it's because it was so realistic as far as the crap that our soldiers have to deal with. I mean, to think that, you know, you're under fire, literally rounds bouncing off of dirt walls inches above your head. You got a guy bleeding out. You got stuff going all over, and as a commander of any level, whether you're a platoon sergeant, platoon leader, company commander, whatever, and you're making on the call, on the fly decisions, what's best for your people at that time, and then to find yourself in a courtroom, you know, and sadly, I was going to say this to him, but he, you know, it really just didn't fit in. But it saddens to me that the same political correctness and flurry of lawyers on a battlefield that we have in the U.S. military has extended to other countries, and the fact that they have to worry and deal with the same stuff, that we send our soldiers to war and we teach them from the day they walk in basic training to find, fix, and finish the enemy. Yet when they walk in, and you know, General Abrams talked about this a little bit last week, you know, now we put them out there and tell them to establish a police station, establish governance, and build a cultural society in a village of made out of dirt. You know, we're expecting that of E7s and platoon leaders, you know, and God forbid they make a mistake, you know.
Well, and I mean, you and I both experienced this, and, you know, one of the frustrations, that, you know, going from 2003 in OIF-1 to, you know, later tours, you know, in 07 and 08, where, man, when I came back in 03 and 04 from, you know, a troops in contact, you know, we got smiles and high fives, and, you know, I had a battalion commander that, you know, if we didn't stack skulls, you know, I was in full kit in the talk with my feet elevated off, you know, a battle desk explaining why, you know, we were not on, like, the decisively awesome end of that exchange. And that's a true story. One time, you know, my battalion commander, like, skinned me up in front of the battle staff because, like, we didn't properly cleanse, you know, the area.
and they weren't talking about Simple Green and Brillo pads either.
Like a squirter got out of a troops in contact, and next thing you know, like, I'm like in the talk with full kit, feet elevated. Good thing, you know, we expended a couple of rounds, so it wasn't as heavy. But the, you know, like, to coming back from convoy security patrols in 2008. where, you know, we were decisively attacked by an enemy force, and then, you know, asked why we, you know, returned fire. You know, why didn't you just, you know, blow through the kill zone? And, you know, everything in my infantry training told me, well, like, that's because I got to come back through here in 6 hours, and I don't want to have to fight this guy twice. I'd rather just kill him once.
Right.
And, you know, having to explain that with sworn statements. And any time our guys did something, you know, we had to then make it, you know, a legal exercise versus, you know, a a celebratory exercise. Like, these guys did their job. They did the right thing. You know, let's support them. Let's endorse their activity. Let's condone their behavior. To now, it's like a completely different animal. But I digress.
That's on point, dude. It's all the same thing in Afghanistan from 06 to 07. In 06, it was shoot first and then inspect them later. And in 07, it was you pull the trigger even on the most justified thing, and there was a 15-6 in a matter of about 8 months. You know, I don't know. I guess they moved the attorneys out of Iraq and brought them over to Afghanistan or something.
Well, you know, they need their badges too.
That's that they do.
Well, you know, we got a pretty cool couple of weeks that have just passed. We got some cool weeks coming up. But we got at least a minute and a half for you to go into a bald man rant. Are you prepared for such an activity?
Yeah, I got one. This guy, the President of the United States, gave me a great one today when he came on, and after almost 8 years of being in office, and his first thing was going to be close down Gitmo, something that's been there long before there was a prison, and came on today and with his sec def by his side, talking about how they were going to shut it down, and they haven't figured out where they're going to put these terrorists and combatants on the battlefield, but they're going to put them in our prisons all over the country, which is going to lead them to having attorneys and long drawn out, and is going to lead them to spreading their hate and filth inside of our prison system like it needs any more. And so it's just absolutely disgusting that he's going to do this last minute sprint before he leaves office, and is going to look to shut it down and move 70 or 80 of the worst prisoners into our country. And what gets me is, you know, when I was in Afghanistan and stuff, and, you know, when we puck somebody and we put them under confinement and we arrested them and we put them up through the system, it's because we caught them. They were doing stuff. They were trying to kill us. They were trying to kill other people, whatever. And a lot of those people never even made it to Gitmo. Like, they were bad. We know they were bad. We caught them bad, and they never even qualified to make the Gitmo. These people have made it all the way there, and yet we're going to just put them in our prison system so they can recruit more. And it's just absolutely disgusting, and I hope somebody can shut this crap down.
Yeah. So you and I are on a very similar page on our rants today, and I too am frustrated that, you know, political promises, you know, replace solid policy. And, you know, there, people in previous administrations, yeah, they made a lot of mistakes. They did things poorly. They didn't exercise great judgment. But, you know, just because you use that as a talking point to get you somewhere that you've been for two terms doesn't equate, you know, dismantling and destabilizing the situation even more. It's such a frustrating time here in America where, you know, it's like, you know, I'm going to double down, I'm going to triple down, I'm going to quadruple down because I said this one thing this one time that was really as stupid as a guy saying free pizza for everyone if you vote for me to be your class president at the University of Notre Dame. You know, like, and I don't know why I picked Notre Dame, just because it's a reputable school. But that's all I got. I share in our bald men rants. I got a day tomorrow where I will be with former Governor Rick Perry of the Republic of Texas. I'm going to spend a couple hours with him on a roundtable speaking about keeping our promises to our vets. So I'm pretty excited to see what that's all about, and I'll give you everyone a full report about that when we return next week with another great show.
Yep, and we do have a great show. We're going to have there's a new website up called counterjihad.com. And we're going to have one of the founders of that site on the show next week. We'll get the information up there. And so you don't want to miss that. Counterjihad.com. It just went up live today. And they're going to keep care in check. So be sure and join us next week here on Stu and the Nun. Toby, thanks a lot, buddy, for another great episode.
Another great episode. Please like us on Facebook. If you like what you see, go to our website and read more of our intel. Follow us at Stu and the Nun on Twitter. Good night.
Good night, everybody.